So this talk this morning, while it's getting loaded up here, it's a rather of a hodgepodge affair, but it was inspired by something that Gary sent me a few weeks ago, which was, I guess they were blog posts, Gary, is that what they were? That somebody was describing a sort of spontaneous enlightenment, somebody wasn't a practitioner.
Yeah, it was, they were emails sent to a blogger, Andrew Sullivan,
okay.
And posted them.
But I'm going to start with a koan, and perhaps before I'm done in some way, I will connect this koan to the other things I'm talking about. And this is one that many of you know from the Mumon Khan, a non-Buddhist questions Buddha. The case. A non-Buddhist in all earnestness asked the world-honored one, I do not ask about words. I do not ask about no words. The world-honored one just sat still. See, there it is. The non-Buddhist praised him, saying, the world-honored one in his great benevolence and mercy has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way. Then bowing, he took his leave. Ananda asked Buddha, what did the non-Buddhist realize that made him praise you so much? The world-honored one replied, he is just like a fine horse that runs even at the shadow of a whip. So, follow that with this blog posting, or email that was posted on the blog. Is that right? Okay. So what this person is saying is, for many years now, I've had the experience of no self. It's not my philosophy. It is actually my experience. This experience is almost impossible to write about, but I will do my best. To begin with, it's not the case that myself vanished one day. Rather, I stopped identifying with self. I realized that a self is just thought that I am aware of, but the self is not what I am. The self has continued to exist as a thought that is very useful for survival, and I expect it to continue to exist until death. So if I am not the self, then what I am? And what am I? I honestly have no idea. For many years, I felt like I was nothing. This sounds terrible, but it's actually very liberating. I did not feel like a dead, cold nothing. I just felt like I was no thing in particular. Compared with identifying as a separate person, that is perpetually fearful, lonely, and confused, being nothing is wonderful. Several years ago, I experienced a shift. I started to feel more and more like I was everything. The first time, the feeling came on very strongly. I was sitting in the Newark airport, staring out at the Queens skyline. I experienced a unity between what I am and everything I am aware of, the beautiful sunrise, the sad buildings, the bagel I was eating, all my thoughts and feelings, etc. I felt like there was no inside and outside to what I truly am, even though I was aware of a self as a thought. For the first time in my life, I truly understood what it meant to love everything unconditionally. This feeling has never gone away since then, although it is often more in the background of my experience while the self is in the foreground. And then he goes on. And then, apparently, what triggered this for this guy was some experience with drugs, I take it.
Mushrooms
in particular. Okay, so we have, this is sort of the context that I'm going to talk a little bit about. So to me, there are several good questions which arise from these descriptions of opening experience. Since these are related to what we speak about as the experience of awakening or enlightenment, I think it'd be worthwhile for us to establish some clarity around the use and meaning of those terms, as well as several others. So let's begin with the term enlightenment. As you've probably heard before, here at Treetop, we don't use that word very often. Part of my personal mistrust for the term enlightenment arises from the fact that in our popular culture, people have a greatly exaggerated view of enlightenment, sometimes attributing magical powers and mysterious gifts to persons who are enlightened. For that reason, among others, I feel strongly that we must studiously avoid using this term and the subsequent attachment to the concept of enlightenment, which is another danger. The goal of Zen practice should not be something called enlightenment. It should simply be the refinement of our lives. What I mean by refinement is that we work every day to live in accordance with the precepts and to manifest loving kindness and compassion in all of our affairs. Seeking anything, particularly enlightenment, is a dangerous spiritual trap. Additionally, I think that the term enlightenment leads us into precarious ground because it lacks precise definition. The Wikipedia Sutra offers the following. The English term enlightenment is a mistranslation of the term bodhi, or awakening, which has entered the Western world via the 19th century translations of Max Müller. It has the connotation of a sudden insight into a transcendental truth, whereas the Buddhist tradition sees the attainment of bodhi as a gradual path of attaining understanding. The term is also being used to translate several other Buddhist terms and concepts used to denote insight, prajna, kensho, and Satori, knowledge, Vidya, and blowing out of disturbing emotions and desires, nirvana, and the subsequent freedom or release, vimutti, and the attainment of Buddhahood as exemplified by Gautama Buddha. In the Western world, the concept of spiritual enlightenment has begotten a romantic meaning. It has become synonymous with self-realization and the true self being regarded as a substantial essence being covered over by social conditioning. Really? Now we have a whole list of inconsistent terms that are sometimes referred to as enlightenment. So in a very real sense, I am not sure what enlightenment is. That's the other reason that I try to avoid the use of the term. Let me share my way of understanding some of the aforementioned terms. Firstly, with respect to enlightenment, where I am comfortable using that term is in reference to Buddhahood as exemplified by Shakyamuni Buddha. Sorry, but none of us will reach that state in this lifetime. As Zen practitioners, we must work towards it, and we certainly have the inherent capacity to get there. But our omnipresent human flaws arise ceaselessly, leaving this depth and clarity of realization way beyond our reach. Kensho or Satori, on the other hand, are concrete experiences or a set of experiences that come with dedicated Zen practice and can be clearly defined much more easily. Kensho can be described as the falling away of body and mind, the direct experience of the obliteration of all boundaries and distinctions, and the opening to the reality of the one body. We sometimes call this realizing the absolute. Sometimes this occurs in one great experience, but more often than not, it unfolds over time in a series of less dramatic, but no less valid experiences. We can also refer to this experience of Kensho as the awakening of our true nature, or to recognizing our self with a capital S. Now, to some extent, it sounds to me like the fellow who wrote that email has experience, in fact, some type of Kensho experience. And that's also consistent with that. What often happens is, I kind of talk about it and think about it in terms of the tide that goes out and the tide that comes in. So often the kind of the first stage of awakening is the tide goes out. There's this sort of emptying of the self. In its sort of most extreme version, that's what Christians refer to as the dark night of the soul. We're deprived of joy and wonder and so on. But then the tide comes back in at some point. Again, what this person is describing, and oh, it's all quite wonderful in here. So that's it. So, responding to the second question that's implied in the postings that Gary sent along, it is entirely possible to have these experiences without being a Zen practitioner. Zen and Buddhism have no monopoly on the opening that occurs in Kensho. In fact, there are many documented instances of spontaneous Kensho, people who haven't been engaged in any regular spiritual practice. But when we talk about our Zen practice in terms of the metaphor of climbing a mountain, the increasingly clear revelation of the absolute through the unfolding of Kensho experiences brings us to the top of the mountain. However, on this particular Zen mountain, the descent is far more arduous than the ascent. In spite of the fact that it may have taken us years to reach this point of opening, it is only the beginning. Eventually, we must extinguish all traces of Zen, all traces of Kensho, all distinctions between the absolute and the relative, until there is one seamless reality. And we must practice ceaselessly to use the clarity gained through our awakening to inform our actions in each and every moment of our lives. If that sounds daunting, that's because it is daunting. If we stay on the path of Zen, we will work on this for the rest of our lives. We will never finish the task. We are not Shakyamuni Buddha. And we will not be enlightened in this lifetime. By the way, I think that, you know, we just, as you read in many of the koans, and we were reading one of the some of us have been working on the transmission of the light, you know, and so those are the enlightenment experiences, as it were, of the first 53 of our ancestors, starting with Shakyamuni and then ending up in China. But I'm more and more convinced that that's translator error, that those are not their enlightenment experience. Those are their, what we, you know, Japanese word, Kensho. I'm not sure what, you know, depending, in that book, the language probably spans from Sanskrit to Chinese, and then it's being translated into English. So I'm not sure what the original terms were. But my guess is there's some confusion of the terminology, or at least as I'm sort of seeing it. So if you want to follow this path of Zen, forget enlightenment, forget Kensho, and just practice. Don't worry. If you practice with sincerity and consistency, you will eventually find that the entire universe is transformed. And when that happens, you will get up every morning and put your pants on one leg at a time, and go forth to try to live the best you can, just engaging fully in the ordinary and the mundane tasks of our lives. Does that sound like what you're doing right now? It is. And yet, it is also completely different. I kind of want to respond to the other piece of this blog post, was the fact that this fella had somehow triggered this experience with a drug. And then there's some further discussion about psychedelics and so on. And, you know, I know some people that are experimenting with that. I know some, you know, people that are using holotropic breathwork, which some of you know Stan Grof developed as a legal alternative to psychedelic drugs, but, you know, to create this kind of drug-induced opening or awakening. And I have very strong feelings about that. Because, again, looking at it from that perspective creates the centrality of the Kensho rather than the centrality of our practice and how we live our lives, number one. Number two, I'm not convinced that drug experiences have any permanency. Now, I have no personal experience. I will deny that I have ever taken any of those drugs. And so I will not make the statement that for me it never lasted. That's one of the problems with that, you know. Maybe, you know, but I won't go further into that aspect of it. But I also think it really springs to some extent out of our this desire in this culture for the instant experience. You know, I'm not going to do the work 20 years on the cushions. I'm going to take the pill. So even if it worked, I would really be opposed to it. Because there's something. Either you all are completely out of your minds, and that is possible. But there's something about sitting on these cushions, about spending the time, about spending the time with a sangha, about working deeply within ourselves, and then about transforming that into informing how we live our lives. That I don't believe any pill can come even, you know, at all close to it. But that's how we want it, we Americans, you know. We want a pill. You know, we don't, if we're depressed, we don't want to go to a therapist and do some work and start changing how we live and think and get more exercise and eat differently and all those things. We want to take the medication. And I'm not saying the medication isn't appropriate and necessary sometimes. Sometimes it is absolutely appropriate and necessary. But in my view, it never should replace the other. You know, I just had this conversation with whom? I think with my primary care physician. But we should always be doing both. We should always be doing both. Medications are not a substitute for our doing the work we need to do in our lives. Whether we're talking about a psychological level, or whether we're talking about a spiritual level. And I don't think we should base our lives on shortcuts. I don't think we should be looking for the instant fix. But again, the reason I brought this koan into it is to make this point about the fact that one doesn't have to be a Buddhist or a Zen practitioner to realize oneself. You know, here, the non-Buddhist, for those who don't know, I mean, Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, and in terms of the transmission of the Dharma, was the third person in the line. He wasn't ready in the lifetime of the Buddha. Mahakashyapa was, but then Mahakashyapa transmitted to Ananda. Okay? So Ananda, at this point, has to have a considerable degree of understanding. And he totally misses it. The Buddha responds with silence, and the non-Buddhist instantly knows what he's communicating. So he has tremendous depth of understanding. We have no monopoly on it. A non-Buddhist in all earnestness asks the world-honored one, I do not ask about words, I do not ask about no words. The world-honored one just sat still. The non-Buddhist praised him, saying, the world-honored one in his great benevolence and mercy has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way. Then bowing, he took his leave. Ananda asked Buddha, what did the non-Buddhist realize that made him praise you so much? The world-honored one replied, he is just like a fine horse that runs even at the shadow of a whip.
I've had a couple of descriptions of Kensho or from my spotty history, and one teacher talked about Kensho or you know, an opening or an experience, a realization. It's sort of like turning on a flashlight in a dark cathedral, and light comes on, and you see a little bit of the frescoes up there, and then, oh, whoa! And it changes the sense of the space. I always like that, you know, because you always have that memory which you can stay attached to. Of, okay, I have that picture of that cathedral, and you can, and part of your process is you need to flesh this thing out. You need, you know, that's what practice is, flesh it out. And the other one, which I don't know whether it's his, Daito, the one described Kensho, or sort of that high, as sort of, he compared it to the prisoners that, the Iranian hostages after they got off the plane. You know, it was, you know, they'd been, you know, they're cooped up, and to just all of a sudden there's freedom, but then they go back to the rest of their lives, and they're paying the bills and yada yada yada, you know, and it's that release. I mean, it's incredibly different, but there's some that sexy intrigue of realization is. It's not the point, you know. The point is that they did come back and they got back to their regular lives.
Yeah. Of course, there are people who disagree with that. Dosho being one. Things we should be, you know, emphasizing that. I think I mentioned before he wrote that piece about boomer teachers, of whom I am one, who put the emphasis on living well rather than on attaining realization. Mm-hmm. And I'm guilty as charged, you know, but I did sort of pointing out there is that other, you know, there is that other perspective, particularly in Rinzai Zen. It's huge, you know what I mean? And that as there, some of you have read accounts, you know, or have done it yourselves, you know, they stay out all, you know, when they're working on Mu and they throw you on Mu as soon as you come in the door. And your first shin, you spend out all night sitting on the hill mooing, trying. And people, you know, it's not uncommon people to have a breakthrough of sorts on their first retreat. But it's so shallow, it's so impermanent, it's so, you know, that I don't see that as having really any value in compared to the kind of thing that happens with years of practice. But the other, you know, thing was what you reminded me of, Dan, is, you know, that one of Kaplow's books, was it Zen Dawn in the West? Or, I don't know, one of them, he has these Kensho descriptions of the most amazing ones, you know. The entire universe transformed in an instant, and I never went back to being an asshole, and, you know. And someone, I don't remember who, it might have even been Reiken Roshi, that said that he did more to set back Zen with publishing that than you know, because sort of a whole generation of people who read that, I was one of them, kind of now had this attachment to this idea of having this amazing experience, you know. And if you're clinging to that, it's a huge obstacle to practice.
A little bit the spirit, the way both of those were presented, I believe, was to try to, yeah, there's that, but that's not the point. You know, in other words, these things happen. Your daily life is the point of this. That's what I got out of.
Yeah, but my little brain, it's like, you know, you've got the big, rich, luscious piece of chocolate cake over here, and then you say, but that's not really the point. The piece of bread that's over here is what we want you to focus on. My little brain is back over here on the cake, you know? And it's like, you know.
When you say about how the experience can be shallow if you just have just a quick awakening like that in the Rinzai, or even using drugs or something like that, I think those experiences can be wonderful, but it's important for me, and it's been important for me to be able to let them go and thank them for arriving and then thank them for leaving and and continue to be present in, you know, in situations where I'm not happy or situations that are a struggle. So just being able to let the shallowness go as well has been helpful for me.
Yeah. There's a Japanese word, makyo, which is often translated as sort of as hallucinations. But I think distractions is a better sort of word. And so the makyo concept says if you're sitting and the Buddha shows up in front of you, it's just makyo, let it go. If angels come fluttering around your head, it's just makyo, let it go. The same is true really of these Kensho experiences. If you have a wonderful Kensho experience, it's just makyo, let it go.
At the same time, I really liked what Dan said about the flashlight. There's this sense that, you know, the three pillars of Zen, and one of them is faith. And a lot of us don't like to think of faith as having anything to do with this, because it's about experiencing it for ourselves. But until we experience it for ourselves, to some degree at least, even if it's just that tiny pinpoint of life, a light, you know, we do sort of have to have faith that that... you know, there's something bigger than ourselves. And so, you know, when that light flickers for even just a second and we see it, it's like, oh, you know, there it is. But we do still have to spend the rest of our lives fleshing that out, like Dan said. But we no longer have to take it on faith that there's something there.
That's what I see as the Rinzai thing, too. You go out and have your flash, they don't say, okay, folk, you know, now you're realized. They say the same thing we do. Sit down and shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
But they are forcing you out of your habitualized mind much more vigorously.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Peter's right about that sort of, you know, you answer your first koans under this tremendous pressure, but it does not mean that you're anywhere really, because everyday life is not putting that same pressure on you to become you know, have this absolute gut response to things.
Or we could see that pinprick of light and say, oh, that's it. I had that experience. Good.
Right.
I mean, Peter, you tell that story all the time of a friend you had that, you know, had his Kensho and it was like a certificate, you know. Oh, I did that, you know.
Yeah.
If people get that message, that's what it is. You get you turn your flashlight on, you see the fresco, and okay, I paid my nickel, I'm ready for the next thing.
You know, but you can feel the staleness if that's where they're at. You can just, it's just like, oh, come on, pal. Go away. You know, and it's just, you know, that's, I think what you're saying is completely the point. Okay, my experience is I attended a workshop which is not Zen, and I had this ooh. And what it did for me is I then had the opportunity to study with a Zen teacher, and that became the primary importance. Doing that workshop again was not, I had no interest in doing it. I wanted a context to put this in. You know, there's so many ways to get lost. I think that dialogue between Rinzai and that argument, you know, which is a supposed argument, you know, because they should both see the dangers inherent to landing on either side of them. And I think your thing about the chocolate cake is perfect. I think it's good. I've been enjoying that chocolate cake way too much.
Now I want some chocolate.
Oh, shut up.
But I mean, you're all saying important things, and Jamie, you're right. And I, you know, sometimes I get sort of alliterative and to make a point. Obviously, it's important. These experiences are also important, and they do what you say. They can reinforce faith. I just think there's so much danger that comes with that. And the other thing is, you know, sometimes people have these spontaneous experiences, and if you're not prepared for it, that, you know, it ends up being psychiatric emergency, because all of a sudden you don't know who you are, you don't know kind of, you know what I mean, that, oh, that, there's no meaning anywhere, and oh my God. And, you know, when that comes in the context of years of spiritual practice, you're prepared for it, and it's contextualized. And I almost never tell this story, but I won't tell the whole story. That's a little bit strange. Just think, the first time that I ever had an experience like that, I'll back it up. For years I used to go to Zen Mountain Monastery, as some of you know, and that was about a 4 or 4.5 hour drive from my home. And I used to think, oh my God, what would happen if I'm driving home from a session or a retreat and all of a sudden I have a Kensho experience and I'm driving on the New York State Thruway, and how's that going to work, and you know, all that. Well, the first time it ever happened to me, it happened on the main turnpike. And it was terrifying. It was not, you know, it was kind of weird and scary when you're driving 70 miles an hour on the main turnpike and mind and body disappear, you know. And yet it works. I mean, there's inherent wisdom there that, you know, you know, the tail doesn't go through the lattice window. But so I think an important part of it is context, an important part.
I don't know why, but I feel like there's like some sort of disagreement in the sense that don't you have to let context go also, you know, and I don't know. Like you said in your talk about, you have to, not you have to, but you talked about, you know, not there not being any more Zen, or, you know, burning the, not burning pages, but well, that was the part in your Dharma talk that you said.
Yeah. But that's about a 10-year process, you know, that comes after realization. You know, it's not that day. I mean, you know, so that's what I'm saying. That's why I was saying that descent. That descent is longer and harder than the ascent. You know, because we do have to lose it all. We have to lose it all. But that's not, you know, we don't do that the first day.
So you build up the context. And
you know, there's also that, there's also the story about Aiken, who, he never had an experience of move. And he did it for years. And he was studying with the guy that did the workshop that Kaplow made the big thing of in Three Pillars of Zen. But he never had that. And, you know, so again, there's that piece of chocolate cake, you know, is you know, it really points out the meaninglessness of that. I have all kinds of faith that he understood Mu, that he got Mu, but he didn't have that thing that is glorified and romanticized, and you know that it is this sort of dark, sexy little thing that you know, people are always hoping for. And the other side is Dogen does not talk about it at all. He just doesn't talk about it. There's an inkling there, you know.
Well, Dogen, I think, was the one who talked about it like, you can get wet by jumping into a lake, or you can get wet by walking through a mist. And Dogen said that it's deeper experience. You get it from walking through the mist. Over time, your robes get soaked.
Mm-hmm. Metaphors are so wonderful.
Well, Suzuki Roshi used that same one about the fog, walking in the fog.
Yeah, I don't know if he got it from Dogen or if he made it
himself.
Oh, he was
constantly plagiarizing from Dogen. Gary, did that respond to kind of any of what you thought about when you...
Yeah, very much. Actually, I'll just mention what I sort of thought you might say was something about how the writer was having this experience, but it was sort of his personal experience, and he wasn't coming back to the marketplace and saving all sentient beings. He didn't have that aspect of it. So
I think that's what I was trying to say. Maybe I didn't say it well. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I missed it.
Okay. I'll have you give my next talk. You just got it. No, I think that's exactly what. At least part of what I meant to say. I was talking about a lot of other contextual pieces, but I guess that's what I was talking about: living each day with loving kindness, mm-hmm. compassion. That kind of thing. That's where the rubber meets the road. Having wonderful experiences. If we look at why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? Well, hopefully, at some level, we have that, some kernel of that bodhisattva motivation, and we're hoping to change the universe in some minuscule way, but nevertheless, to leave this life, to leave this world a little bit better for our presence here. And having an experience doesn't do that, but living well every day does that. That's the difference. That's the piece that's the piece that changes the universe. Not the Kensho, but the Kensho is a tool. It helps me do that. So both things are true.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.
Shall we do some quick introductions for our...
Yeah, please.
Dan, you want to start? Introductions.
Dan Bloomer, I live in Waterville.